If you enjoy the content and point of view, please leave a favorable review on Stitcher, iTunes, or Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, it's Shirley Gutkowski at Crosslink Radio. Thank you for joining us today. This is Health from the Eye Teeth on Down, and this is one of our episodes on sugar. A research paper came out recently, Cochrane Report, which is called a meta-analysis of a lot of xylitol research studies, and they came to a very unusual conclusion that xylitol doesn't work as well as what we thought it did. So we're going to have a little different kind of a program today on xylitol, the sugar. Dr. John Peldiak is here. He is a retired dentist from Michigan who has a long history of researching xylitol and xylitol products. And he's here to talk to us today about that study and xylitol in general. So stay tuned and enjoy.
As we just got this new paper released on xylitol-containing products for preventing dental caries in children and adults, a review article that is creating quite a stir. It's from the Cochrane collaboration from the United Kingdom. And their conclusion was, surprisingly enough, that there's not enough evidence to clearly state that xylitol could help prevent dental caries. Kind of a shocking conclusion.
What?
That doesn't really seem to even match up with the material that they have in the paper itself. So we do want to go through some of that and talk about how they could have come to that conclusion. They say, let's quote them accurately, the evidence on the effects of xylitol products is not clear, and therefore it is important to summarize the available evidence to determine its effectiveness and safety.
So, how is that possible? How is that possible when we have a stack of research papers that shows exactly the opposite, from how the bacteria work individually with xylitol present up to population studies that show a reduction in cavities from those people who are using xylitol?
I believe this review paper, it's not new research. It's just it reviews existing research. Mm-hmm. And what they did was went through the various trials that had xylitol as a major part of the program, and looked for flaws in the trial, in the experimental design or the trial design, and they ended up only reviewing 10 papers. So out of the,
wow,
the hunt of xylitol papers that are available, they only reviewed 10. Now, as I'm going down the list, I'm looking at it, and three of them had to do with xylitol in a fluoride toothpaste, xylitol added to a fluoride toothpaste, which they admitted did have an additional preventive effect. So that's three out of their seven right there.
Wow.
That and one was Dr. Milgram's study on using xylitol syrup in young children to, mm-hmm, prevent early childhood caries. And although that had a positive effect, statistically significant, they kind of downplayed that one based on the design of the trial, that it wasn't purely xylitol that was being used. It was a xylitol, and the control had some xylitol also. It wasn't completely xylitol-free. So, again, they're sort of nitpicking, and they're going after the trial designs and looking for places where xylitol doesn't measure up. And I'll give you a couple other examples here. I'm looking again at the list. One of them is the xylitol wipes, the baby wipes.
Yeah.
And another one is the xylitol tablet in the pacifier. And And both of those trials, oh, and then there was a third one with the xylitol in a pacifier where they were basically testing a probiotic. They weren't testing the xylitol.
Mm.
So on those three trials, you're talking about milligrams of xylitol. In other words, in all these studies, there's only one that used more than 5 grams a day, and that's the Milgram study where they did get a 58% reduction in caries by using the xylitol at a level of 8 grams per day. The others, including, of course, the EXACT trial is there, where mm-hmm. Xylitol tablets were used in an adult population. By the way, they got an 8% reduction in tooth decay in the people that used the xylitol tablets, only 5 grams a day, where Dr. Milgram previously stated that adult populations need at least 6.88.
So really what the study did was to show that Dr. Milgram was right, that you need more, but everybody, you know, everybody's kind of always leaning towards the negative. So yes, it proved that 5 grams isn't enough during a day, or 4 grams.
Well, they actually did get an 8% reduction in tooth decay with the xylitol group, but if you look at their lines on the graph, it fell just short of what you'd need for statistical significance.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, they said that the trial was a failure for xylitol, even though there was a positive result. Maybe if they would have continued it longer. This is an adult population, so how many caries do they get? And also, they didn't even mention what the placebo was in the placebo tablets. And mm-hmm. again, the dose was just not strong enough from what we know mm-hmm. about use of xylitol now. So anyway, so there's the 10 studies, and really the only one that really throws a wrench into what we've been saying about xylitol as being superior to, for instance, other sugar-free products is not with the upstart erythritol, but we've talked about that for a while, and you talked with Peter DeCock about the dental benefits of erythritol. And that goes, it sort of follows in line with xylitol because erythritol is a 4-carbon polyol. Xylitol is 5-carbon. So those two are different. They're qualitatively different than the other sugar substitutes we talk about. They're in their own special categories. So, but the one study that throws a wrench into that is the one from that they've done recently in Estonia where they compared xylitol with erythritol and sorbitol. And sorbitol was supposed to be the control where actually you get some benefit from the sorbitol.
Yeah.
But
hardly.
We'll go into that a little bit, the difference between them. But it turned out that the xylitol group did just about the same as the sorbitol group, even a little worse. And the erythritol group did significantly better than the sorbitol and xylitol groups. So that's the one where it's a really surprising result because you would expect xylitol to be about on the same level as erythritol. We just don't know that much about erythritol because they haven't done nearly as many studies, but it mm-hmm. looks pretty good.
Yeah.
But when you talk to the researchers on that, they'll tell you privately that there were problems with the study and they knew it even before they got started as far as getting cooperation in the school that was using the xylitol as opposed to the other centers that were using the other products. So, again, one study doesn't make a complete library of work.
Right.
And that certainly could be followed up on, and we certainly believe that erythritol could have a strong anti-caries influence,
mm-hmm.
but we would think that just based on the biochemistry, the microbiology, the physical chemistry, that they would be more or less, xylitol and erythritol would be more or less equivalent.
Right.
And then, of course, you go into other reasons for why you would prefer using erythritol or xylitol in any particular situation. But they both look like they would be very very good as an anti-caries agent.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so
Go ahead. I mean, there's just so many things that I want to say too right now. Go ahead, finish up.
Yeah, it is really frustrating because when you look at their exclusion criteria, they threw out any study that had sugar involved in any way. So that throws out all the earlier studies that was comparing xylitol to sucrose, where you got the huge, 90% reductions in tooth decay.
Right.
Because you would take sucrose, replace the sucrose chewing gum with xylitol, or take the sucrose out of the diet and replace it with xylitol as much as possible. But it threw out the Belize study, which did the head-to-head comparison of xylitol and sorbitol, another sugar-free
right.
ingredient.
Mm-hmm.
That was the definitive study. They had huge groups of they had the whole country involved.
In the population, right. Yeah, population study, not a lab study, not a bunch
right.
of kindergartners. It was the whole country.
Just about. And they were able to break it down, not just xylitol versus sorbitol. It was they had sugar gum. They had a sorbitol gum. They had a mix. They had two mixtures of sorbitol and xylitol chewing gum. They had pure xylitol gum. They had xylitol or sorbitol gum as both sticks and as pellets.
Yeah, right.
And the way the statistics lined up, you just look at it and you say, my gosh, xylitol is much better than sorbitol. That's not even close.
Mm-hmm.
And this over a period of 3 years. So you wonder on some of these studies, the ones that were mentioned in the Cochrane review, that they're using really low amounts of xylitol. Why would they even use these studies? They're throwing out the best studies because of their selection criteria. Coming up with the conclusion that we can't really make a conclusion about xylitol. And yet, within their paper itself, it definitely shows the trend that xylitol has a favorable influence, even if it's not used often enough or in high enough concentration. The tendency is positive, and the one study that throws a wrench into it is that one with the erythritol, which might have its own problems with how the study was set up.
Well, isn't that true that with every study has some level of weakness? There's always some little goofy thing that kind of throws it off a little bit. And the problem with these reviews is that none of the studies were using the same parameters. So when they asked the question, they had to throw out a lot of the studies because they weren't following using the same parameters, or they weren't, or they had too many variables that weren't accounted for or something like that. And that to me is a problem system-wide in dentistry. And when we look at some of the studies that are so profound using xylitol, I don't even care about these kind of meta-analysis studies. They don't make sense at all to me.
Right, exactly. Because for one thing, just as I mentioned, they threw out all the best studies.
Mm-hmm.
And they threw out the mother-child studies. They didn't even include those. So they threw out the transmission studies. They threw out the studies of long-term effects, which is what we're really interested in. Because look at it this way. You can get a salivary effect from sorbitol. There's no doubt about it. You can stimulate saliva.
Yes.
The acid production is much less than with sucrose or other sugars. And if you continue to use sorbitol, you can keep the saliva going and tend to suppress the caries activity. However, those same bacteria, the sugar-eating bacteria, can live on sorbitol. You don't suppress those at all. So that when you take you take your foot off the brake, by continuing to apply sorbitol, and you go switch back to a so-called normal diet, you've lost that advantage. Whereas with xylitol, we don't know about erythritol yet, but with xylitol, we know there's a persistence. You've addressed the microbiome. You've addressed the
right.
bile at a basic level, deep down, where where the changes will persist over time. So to me, that's really critical that they didn't do any analysis of, for instance, during times of tooth eruption, how persistent is the effect. What they're doing with the xylitol wipes at time of tooth eruption is you could almost expect that any kind of wipe that you use at that time is going to have some benefit, because you're just talking about milligrams of xylitol anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But what they don't do is follow up and go down the line and say, what happens to those primary teeth until they're exfoliated, which they did in Finland, by the way. They did follow all those children who had the xylitol mothers, the mothers who were chewing the xylitol gum.
Right.
Children got a much lower caries rate, even than the ones who are, than the mothers who got chlorhexidine.
6 years later, yeah.
and even years, they checked until the last baby tooth was exfoliated and did the analysis, and did, because they want to do an economic analysis to see if the xylitol was worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And they concluded that, yes, xylitol was cost-effective when used that way. So those are the kind of studies that mean something that were never even included in this type of review.
I agree. That's one of the leading benefits for me as a dental hygienist that xylitol provides over everything else that we have available to reduce dental decay, cavities. The use of xylitol for approximately 1 year, right, five times a day-ish, for about a year, will give you lasting results 5 years out. Even if you stop chewing the gum at the 1 year mark or using xylitol ever again, you will still have benefits. You'll still have less decay than your other neighbor kids. You'll still have better teeth. You'll still have all these benefits, even though you never even apply it again. And we never see that kind of results with a fluoride study ever.
Exactly right, and especially when you talk about the first permanent molars,
mm-hmm.
where they follow those in the Belize study, they follow them in the Finland study, and found that those teeth persist, the protection that xylitol provided while being used persisted even when the xylitol is discontinued. And that's really critical, that if from a public health point of view, that if you could target xylitol at just the right times when the teeth are erupting, if you can modify the biofilm right at that time and have the teeth erupt into a non-acidic environment where they're less likely to be colonized by the acidic type bacteria, that is going to persist year after year. Once you've established the biofilm, it's going
right.
to persist. So to help get the children through their cavity prone years, until they're, you know, exposed to other influences, like when they have close friends that will contact their oral biofilm and exchange with them. So at least you know that time when they're growing up and maturing, and as their permanent teeth are coming in, you'll have a real nice environment to have the teeth erupt properly, and that way you don't get the inner dental decay. You don't get the loss of space. You don't get the same orthodontic problems because you've addressed the biofilm at a critical point.
And it's over and above just stopping sugar. And that's one of the pieces that I'd like to continuously bring forward during these sugar episodes, is that sugar and sweetness is an innate, bred in, evolutionarily saving attribute. It is something that we are born with, a taste for sugar. It's not something that you learn. People have to survive, and the sweetest foods are usually the safest foods until man came in and started doctoring things up. So when we're talking about, you know, eliminating sugar, which is one thing, but replacing it with xylitol gives us even more benefits than just getting rid of the sugar.
Oh, exactly. And this is something that's really worthwhile going back in time a little bit to see where this all started, where xylitol was essentially discovered and synthesized first around 1890. And for many years, it was just a laboratory curiosity. It was only during World War II that xylitol became a little more prominent because of the sugar shortages in Europe at the time. And the other sources of sweetness were being sought. And in Russia and in Finland, they recognized that they could use birch sugar, which they call birch sugar. They could make a xylitol from that and from their birch trees and have at least a small amount of xylitol available. So that's when xylitol first began to be used. It is a bit of a misconception that the cavity rates plummeted in Finland because of their use of xylitol during World War II, because xylitol was still expensive, it was rare, mm-hmm. And it was not widely available. So the drop in caries rates were mostly attributed to just the lack of sugar altogether, and also there were periods of hunger, too, where food just wasn't readily available, so there wasn't much snacking. There was more time going without food, where there was, you don't keep feeding the bacteria, in other words, all day long. So, but it was established during World War II that xylitol could be used as a human in human food. Then after, in the 1950s, there's a lot of activity in biochemistry, figuring out all these biochemical pathways, and that's when they found that xylitol was a constituent of a fairly major biochemical pathway, and that our bodies make about 5 to 15 grams a day. It's about a tablespoon under normal conditions, and during illness, that could be revved up to a greater amount. It was also found that the body could process relatively huge amounts of xylitol by different pathways, and xylitol began to be used in medical practices, for instance, in severely ill patients in IVs, in as an energy source other than glucose. Wouldn't send the blood sugar into orbit when you put an IV with some glucose and xylitol mixed together. So there was a good deal of research with the medical uses of xylitol. I've got a book about the medical applications of xylitol published in 1969. That never even mentioned dental. It didn't even mention dental.
Wow.
It was all about medical uses for xylitol, including use in some anemias, similar to sickle cell anemia.
Really?
To prevent red blood cells from lysing, from breaking up. It's been used as an energy source for heart muscle, and it tends to be replaced now by ribose, which is in the same family as xylitol, 5-carbon sugar. It was used in for diabetics, and that was the first major use for xylitol as a food was in the diabetic diet, mostly in Russia. And then in severely ill patients, like burn patients who had trouble controlling their blood sugar, it was used in IV nutrition as an energy source for those patients. So it's got quite a history of use. Even before dental got involved, it was noted that xylitol had some of these antimicrobial properties, so it started to be tested, again, mostly in Finland in the late 1960s, early 1970s, because the Finn Sugar Company had come up with a way to make xylitol that was much less costly than what they had before. And they said, well, we could make this in pretty good amounts, and we already know it's part of our natural metabolism, so what can we do with it? And they turned the problem over to some of the researchers in Finland, and they said, well, let's see what it does when the animals eat huge amounts of xylitol. And one thing they found out was they didn't get any cavities.
So even the early animal studies showed a reduction in decay.
Oh, they certainly did. And then they did comparisons. They said, well, let's try sorbitol and the other sweeteners. Everyone was considering at the time that there might be substitutes for sucrose sugar, so let's investigate some of these. And when they ran the panels, xylitol just stood out. They said, this is different. This one really is much different than the others. It's almost eliminating tooth decay in the lab animals. So that's when they took that to plaque studies in the early 1970s, and from there did the turku sugar studies in the early 1970s, where they took all the sugar out of the diet of groups of young volunteers and replaced the sugar products with xylitol products. And those are the groups that got nearly no new tooth decay. They officially rated it at greater than 85% reduction in tooth decay. Some of the researchers will say that it, because of statistics, there's really almost no tooth decay at all in the xylitol group. But that, again, wow, was using huge amounts of xylitol compared to what we're recommending for dental benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So they ran a parallel study. They already knew the xylitol was working, and they did all sorts of associated studies, not just tooth decay studies, but they were doing blood tests and saliva tests and looking at all different parameters of what the xylitol was doing, and found that it was a normal physiological carbohydrate-like material, didn't raise the blood sugar very much, did supply some energy, and had no adverse effect other than a transient gastrointestinal effect, which the volunteers got used to after about a week or two, and they could use just as much xylitol as the group that was using sugar was using sucrose.
Wow.
But then they went to, they said, well, this is too expensive. What else can we do? They said, well, we can put it in chewing gum. Let's see how that works. And they were amazed to find that the chewing gum group using only a tiny amount of xylitol compared to the diet group was getting similar results. I mean, on the order of 85% reduction in tooth decay. This is just amazing. So that's when xylitol started gaining momentum in Finland, and they started making products after that. And then about that time in the United States, because I was in dental school, late 70s, guess what? Aspartame came out.
Mm.
So we read about the turku xylitol studies, and our teachers at school all said, yeah, isn't that great? See, you just get rid of sugar in the diet, and everything will be fine. And now we've got aspartame. Remember NutraSweet?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's when it came out. And that's what sort of diminished the idea of using xylitol.
It's funny to me how they took that, how they had a different takeaway message. The idea that they just removed sugar and that it would, that they would have seen the same results just by substituting sucrose with any other sugar, including aspartame.
Well, that's the amazing thing, is that you still see that in the Cochrane report. They mentioned the same sort of thing. They said, we're not really sure if it's the xylitol or that you just got rid of sugar at these critical times. So like after meals. And it's just mind-boggling because, like I say, all the lab information, all the microbiology information was showing that there's something fundamentally different about xylitol as opposed to these other sweeteners. Now, we could get into, and you will on your later show, some of these high-intensity sweeteners where you just use a little, tiny, micro amounts of it. That's not going to have a big influence on the oral flora. Xylitol is a bulk sweetener, the same bulk, same amount as you would use regular sugar. So that does have a profound influence on the microflora because you're feeding it fairly large amounts.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found is because of the structure of xylitol that it doesn't break down into lactic acid, even if bacteria get adapted to it, even if they could use xylitol as a fuel source, it still doesn't break down to lactic acid like some of these other sugar substitutes will.
And acid is acid, you know. Citric acid is a little worse than lactic acid, but acid is still going to be the main ingredient in tooth enamel breakdown.
Right. So if most of the xylitol is it's not well absorbed. You're only going to absorb a certain amount of it.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to absorb fewer calories from it than you would from regular sugar. So it's got these enormous metabolic benefits too that are coming out lately in the literature. We've just got a couple papers out about xylitol improving all the parameters of metabolic syndrome. And metabolic syndrome is that
pre-diabetes,
the signs of pre-diabetes, including high pressure, low HDL, high LDL, and higher high blood sugars. So there's Xylitol also was seen to be anti-catabolic, that helped prevent the breakdown of lean muscle tissue. So if you're losing fat, you don't want to lose muscle and bone along with it. You want to preserve those tissues, and xylitol helps do that. Xylitol helps prevent osteoporosis in the experimental models, because xylitol acts as a carrier for calcium. So it's got these physical chemical properties also, besides simply the other things that we were talking about, from which do affect dentally also. It helps xylitol helps with remineralization of teeth, but it also helps with calcium absorption in the gut and strengthening the bones. Xylitol is also found in these animal models to keep collagen younger, and that means, you know, that's their structural proteins. We want our structural proteins to be younger and stronger and not become brittle and wrinkle up, as tend to do as we get older. So there's a lot of really important benefits of xylitol beyond the dental. And, of course, it was found to help prevent upper respiratory infections just sort of by accident. By the way, it was being used to prevent tooth decay. They noticed in their daycare centers in Finland that the children were missing fewer school days because of upper respiratory infections. So they ran trials there and found that xylitol could prevent otitis media, the middle ear infection. So it's got widespread value, and sometimes you wonder how that can be. And there's a new paper by Aline Ferreira from Brazil, who talks about the anti-adhesive effects of xylitol, how xylitol makes the bacterial cell surfaces slicky, not sticky, so they to slide off. They don't tend to clump together. They don't organize. They don't get into an organized biofilm. They don't, the receptors of some of these tissues are taken up by the xylitol, but not usable. In other words, the xylitol doesn't make the next attachment that could lead to something harmful, to a harmful result. So it's really an interesting way of looking at it. And they say that way, we can bypass microbial resistance, that the bacteria, it doesn't matter how well they get used to xylitol, it's not going to do them any good, because that property will persist. And that's what's really interesting about xylitol, as opposed to, let's say, the sorbitol, where we saw that, you know, the growth could still take place. You remove the sorbitol, and the pathogens can grow right back.
Yeah, it's really crazy how beneficial xylitol is. And I think the key here that nobody is really latching on to is this idea that it is made in the body. It is part of what we do. It is not an eliminated, you know, some of the things that we make in our body are just there just to hurry up and get out. But it has a function in our body. It's like cannabis almost. I mean, we have reasons for xylitol to be in our body. And so that is a feature that's almost never discussed. Do we know why we're making the xylitol in our bodies, and how it works in the rest of the body? Is it part of other pathway, or how does that go?
Sure. The major one we're talking about is the way xylitol links up the different sizes of sugars. Most of what we eat is 6-carbon based, and xylitol is a 5-carbon sugar. And if you consider what the 5-carbon sugars do in the body and how important they are, it really becomes crucial to have these pathways in place, because we don't need a huge amount of it, but it's fairly significant. We're talking about, you know, a tablespoon a day is quite a bit, really, for a metabolite to be made in the body. What it's doing is linking up that five carbon sugar pool, which is the ribose. A lot of people have heard of ribose sugar. which is necessary for the heart, for energy for the heart muscle. Sometimes in congestive heart failure, it's recommended to take a spoonful or so of ribose every day, ribose sugar. And but also, if you consider the names DNA, RNA, is deoxyribonucleic acid and ribose. Okay. In other words, ribose base, 5-carbon base. Well, that's our genetic material. That codes for proteins. That if we don't have that, and that's what we're mentioning in terms of very ill people, burn patients and so forth, their turnover of that pathway goes way up because they're trying to build and repair and replace tissue. So those pathways are extremely critical. The ATP molecule, most people have heard of that, the adenosine triphosphate, which is our energy molecule. Well, ribose forms part of that molecule. So we have to have these 5-carbon sugars for optimum health just to get by. So that's why our body will make these sugars even if we don't consume any. And that xylitol is just an intermediate in that pathway. It's part of the chain as it moves from one compound to another. Xylitol is part of that. So we always have xylitol in our system. It's not an artificial ingredient that has never been in existence on the face of the earth until 1997 or whenever some of these. It's always been with us. So in that sense, there's nothing strange or unnatural about it.
Okay, so this is I'm going to go out on a limb here, and it's almost a pun. So there's a lot of discussion about xylitol that comes from birch versus xylitol that comes from other pulpy plants. So if xylitol is made in the body, is it made in the body because we're eating birch bark or anything like that? I mean, can we make that circle there that birch sugar is better for us or less harmful or whatever than sugar made from, I don't know, corn?
No, xylitol is xylitol. It's just one single molecule. There's no mirror image of it. It's the way it is. It exists in one form. Mm-hmm. So there are no multiple forms of it from different sources. So no matter where it comes from, xylitol is xylitol. You could eat some xylitol and get some in your system, or you could eat corn and your body will make xylitol out of it eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it won't convert all of it to xylitol, but a tiny percentage will convert to xylitol just in the course of our daily metabolism. So it doesn't matter where the source comes from. We can even make glucose from proteins. Even if you're on a low carbohydrate diet, you'll still make some glucose, and some of that will convert to xylitol.
So you don't have to be super careful about buying a gum or a sprinkling sugar or any other kind of xylitol product that comes from this source or that source or another source.
They're all the same.
They're all the same. So people who are allergic to birch or people who are allergic to corn or something like that, how does that interfere with anything? I've heard that conversation a number of times.
Right. There really should be no allergy issues involved because all that would have been filtered out, and all you would have left is the pure xylitol, which would have no protein left to it, which is the allergenic portion. So if it's it really should not be an issue. There are maybe a couple reports of someone reporting an allergy to xylitol, but it's extremely rare, and then you wonder if it was that or something else associated with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I always wonder that myself. I'm like, okay, there's no proteins. It's pretty far removed. So I don't know. I'm not. I can see where people would maybe think that they're having an allergy because you do get kind of a gurgly stomach. And if you eat a big pile of it accidentally, I know some big company made some big picnic or something, and they made all the lemonade with xylitol, and everybody was lined up for the porta potties later in the day. So
that's not a good idea.
No,
it's like dealing with dietary fiber. You know, if you happen, if you're on a low fiber diet, and suddenly somebody says, "Here, you know, have this high fiber whatever drink or or so." It'll have the same effect. you need about a week or 2 weeks to get used to increasing amounts of xylitol. By the way, that's an interesting point, is the way soluble fiber works. You know, it comes in as a carbohydrate,
mm-hmm.
but it's processed in your gut much like a fat. It's broken down by bacteria into volatile fatty acids. And with xylitol, that's mostly butyrate, which is a four-carbon compound, which has been associated with improved health of the gut, because butyrate's really necessary for proper functioning of the gut lining. So xylitol in modest amounts would actually be beneficial for the colon.
Oh, my God. The benefits of xylitol just keep piling on. It's really amazing. It's amazing how beneficial this is, including beneficial for the reduction of dental decay.
And also reduction of Porphyromonas gingivalis, which is an important periodontal pathogen as an initiator and progressing of periodontal disease. Xylitol helps to prevent the growth and the inflammatory cytokine expression of P. gingivalis. So xylitol should have an inflammation dampening effect
mm-hmm.
on gingival tissue.
I'm telling you, it just keeps going on and on and on. Thank you so much for talking about xylitol with us today, with the added extended version of CrossLink Radio, talking about the new study that was just released, what was it, like last week, not even a week ago, about xylitol. Thank you, Dr. Peldiak, so much for helping us understand xylitol so well.
Oh, thank you for having me on. Surely appreciate it.
You're very welcome. And there we have it, CrossLink Radio, the extended version. You got an extra couple of minutes on your exercise cycle if that's what you're doing during this time. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk again soon.